be here, and I appreciate very much the invitation. And I hope you find this to be of some interest, as I do. The last question from the previous talk actually turns out to have been a nice segue into this one. So, I won't try to explain the title or the subtitle because they're either self-explanatory or you just have to listen to the talk. The structure, more or less, of what I'm going to talk about, I'm going to spend a little bit of time with background thoughts, which is more or less my attempt to try to reconcile sort of my own attitudes about a bunch of issues that are on the table here with like the terminology and the classification system and things like that that some other people have adopted. And then I'm going to step a little bit away from that and just say something a little bit more explicitly about why I'm interested in constructing a theory of this type. That is to say, a pilot wave theory of exclusively local beables. And so now you know what TELB stands for. And so then I will present one, which is really a kind of ridiculous and unbelievable theory that I don't take very seriously myself, but I think it's a kind of gesture towards something that conceivably might be taken seriously someday. So that's the structure of this. And then there is not only time for questions from you at the end, but some questions that I have myself that maybe you can help me answer. Okay, so let's jump right in. I mean, the big question that brings us all here to this conference is, what's the status of the quantum state? Does it refer somehow directly to something that's physically real, or does it refer to our knowledge or something else? A really sort of obvious but also crucial background point that I just want to make explicit. I think probably everyone either has this in mind explicitly or implicitly already, but it's worth saying it explicitly. The question is really not just sort of what's the status of the quantum state simpliciter, but rather what's the status of the quantum state for a given candidate theory. And then it's a, you know, at least a separable issue, which theory should we believe, and of course which theory we believe might hinge on, you know, what the status of the various things in that theory is. But we shouldn't think that there's some sort of one true answer to the question at hand here. And of course, getting straight on all this requires us at some point to figure out exactly what we mean by a theory and how we classify all that. And so that's what I want to kind of jump into and talk about. So obviously we've heard a lot about this kind of classification scheme or these systems of concepts. It's unfortunate that that keeps coming. Well, okay, so we all know by now this terminology, psi ontic versus psi epistemic, that Rob and Nick Harrigan, I guess, invented. At least their paper is where I learned about it from. And so mostly what I want to do for the first few minutes here is sort of say some things about that sort of terminology and that classification scheme. More or less, I have some reservations or concerns about it that I'd like to talk about. So the first point is just that the terminology psi epistemic may end up grouping together some different theories or some different attitudes, which are really quite fundamentally different. And we've already seen, you know, examples from sort of both the subclassifications in the talks to this point of the conference. So, you know, the idea is that the sort of obvious kinds of examples that you would have in mind as a psiontic theory are like the pilot wave theory, these various versions of GRW, some kind of many worlds type theory where you're, you know, realist about the quantum state. And then the psi epistemic, at least one, you know, well represented and influential category of such views is, for example, quantum Bayesianism, and probably the Copenhagen approach fits in here, and Ballantine's statistical interpretation, although I think he's kind of a special case. And so the point is that, you know, if you just sort of look at that list as a way of trying to figure out what this terminology means, you think that the psiontic theories are ones who are realist about the quantum state, but you might get the impression that the psi epistemic, you know, people or theories or whatever are people who are sort of anti-realist in a slightly more general, slightly more principled, slightly more philosophical way. You know, so what I want to stress is that you know, that's a sort of potentially misleading implication of the terminology, and we shouldn't let the terminology fool us, you know, cause us to forget about the possibility of being anti-realist about the quantum state, but also very much, you know, realist in the sort of more general philosophical sense that motivates, you know, the people who like the pilot wave theory and GRW and that kind of thing. So that was my first concern. The second concern is just that once you adopt this sort of philosophically realist attitude, then it seems like classifying a theory as psi epistemic is just sort of a funny way of saying what is in fact attempted to be conveyed by that. It basically means that according to the theory, the quantum state doesn't really exist, the wave function doesn't really exist. But then it's sort of weird to classify it as, you know, that object which doesn't exist according to the theory as having, you know, any particular status according to the theory epistemic, right? And you would never say about these, you know, objects from the history of science that nobody believes in any longer, like epicycles or phlogiston, you would never sort of classify a contemporary theory as epistemic with respect to those things. Or rather, you might do so, but it would be a kind of weird, you know, specialized thing to do. It seems to me much more straightforward to classify contemporary theories, you know, with respect to phlogiston or something, as just theories that say that there's no such thing as phlogiston, right? I mean, that's kind of the obvious thing if you're interested in, you know, the status of phlogiston vis-a-vis contemporary theories. From some perspective like that, I'm motivated to suggest classifying theories not by what status this one proprietary object of ordinary quantum mechanics has with respect to the theories, but rather simply classifying them in terms of what they say exists. This seems sort of more neutral somehow. And I like Bell, and I like Bell's terminology, beables, for what it is a theory says exists. So I will adopt that terminology. Now, my third concern about this psi epistemic versus psi ontic issue is that the particular criterion that was proposed in this paper by Rob and Nick Harrigan for, you know, deciding for a given candidate theory whether the quantum state is ontic seems sort of either problematic, or what it's getting at is sort of not what I'm interested in when I think about whether something has an ontic status. Basically, the criterion amounts to anything that's uniquely defined by the stuff that's sort of openly posited as physically real by a theory is also physically real. Okay, so here are some examples of things which I think by this criterion would, you know, acquire ontic status. So, you know, just in regular Newtonian physics of particles, the center of mass of some system would have ontic status, right? It's sort of part of the ontology of that theory. The phase space point, right, considering sort of the universe of classical physics, and so presumably phase space itself would be part of the ontology of that theory. You can make some kind of crazy field out of electric and magnetic fields, and then that acquires ontic status by this criterion. And maybe a more sort of serious example that has some relevance for, you know, contemporary research, and this will make no sense to probably most people, but those of you who are aware of these recent modifications of, you know, the so-called bare GRW theory, where people contemplate adding a mass density field or a flash ontology to the theory, from the perspective that anything that's, you know, well uniquely defined by the base ontology of the theory is also part of the ontology, this would be sort of a pointless complication of the theories, right? The mass field and the flash ontology are already in the ontology of bare GRW, according to this perspective, and I just think that's wrong. So you can see the concern. You know, I felt sort of embarrassed about criticizing this without proposing something in its stead, and so what I would propose instead is simply a sufficient condition for ontic status. If you can't formulate a theory without a certain thing, then that certain thing is ontic for that theory. Now, if you think about what that means, it means almost nothing, because there are all kinds of different formulations of what we normally think of as a single theory. And so my reading is there are going to be lots and lots and lots of different theories. So, you know, for example, in the case of classical electromagnetism, you could say the electric and magnetic fields are real and the potentials aren't. Or you could say vice versa, which I guess would sort of commit you to there being one true gauge or something like that. Or you could say they're both real, and these are just all going to be different theories. Right? So it's just sort of up to the person saying what his or her theory is to assert as, you know, part of the articulation of what the theory consists of, what has beable status for that theory. And what this, you know, sufficient condition amounts to is just that you know, you can't deny beable status to something that is in your formulation of the theory in a kind of inevitable way. Now you'll see soon how all of this relates to what I want to do. So the upshot is basically this. There are, you know, lots of theories that are formulated already in terms of the quantum state, and so lots and lots of very different kinds of theories to contemplate in which that is, in which that's a beable. To me, though, the interesting question is, can you formulate a theory that somehow, that one can somehow take seriously, that's maybe empirically equivalent to ordinary quantum mechanics, or at least close enough for all practical purposes? Can you formulate such a theory without ever mentioning the quantum state, right? And if you can do that, then, and I think only then, would you really have any kind of reasonable claim that, you know, according to that theory, the quantum state doesn't exist, doesn't have a kind of ontic status, okay? And then this further question, which is sort of what's gotten at by this Speckens-Harrigan criterion for ontic status, namely, you know, suppose you had such a theory, then there's this further question, okay, do the beables of that theory uniquely determine a quantum state or not? And I just don't care. And so, you know, I would be completely open to theories of both types, and there would have to be some, you know, criteria for deciding which theory you think is best from, you know, that menu. So I just don't get the motivation for this research program of kind of insisting on, you know, a theory that is in many ways like the kind that I would want to consider, but putting this extra requirement on that the, you know, the quantum state should not be uniquely defined by the beables of the theory. Okay. So I want to propose something like that. But the motivation for doing what I want to do really doesn't have anything to do, actually, with the question of the status of the wave function, at least not in that sense. That is to say, the motivation is not just to construct an example of a theory for which psi fails to have this ontic status. Rather, for me, the motivation is to construct a theory which has a plausible ontology, and then for me, again, this implies finding a theory in which the wave function is not ontic, because I just don't know how to understand what it would mean for this object, which in Bell's terminology is a non-local beable, to be a real thing. I mean, it's, you know, at least the sort of straightforward way of understanding that would be that it's some kind of physically real field on some, you know, abstract high-dimensional space. And that's a, you know, I think we should be open about the fact that that's a really bizarre kind of thing. So I think I probably have a kind of unique attitude about where we should get our beliefs about plausible ontology, that is to say, what it means for an ontology to be plausible. I think most people's attitude probably is that the plausibility is somehow related to the naturalness of reading the ontology off from the given theoretical formalism. And my attitude, in a way, is just the reverse. I think we do, in fact, and in addition, we should, have, you know, we should develop some ideas about what ontology we, you know, expect or consider likely or consider reasonable based on looking at, you know, the qualitative outcomes of certain experiments. And then on that basis, we should try to construct a formal theory. If you think about, you know, how, for example, classical electromagnetism was developed, it was precisely that way, right? People like Faraday came along and argued strongly for the existence of fields, and it was really only as a result of that, the sort of now existing qualitative beliefs about what the ontology of a theory would have to be like, that then Maxwell could sort of come along and formulate, you know, precise mathematical laws for this ontology. So there's this quote I like very much from Bell, which sort of captures my attitude about this. Is it not clear from the smallness of the scintillation on the screen that we have to do with a particle? And is it not clear from the diffraction and interference patterns that the motion of the particle is directed by a wave? So, of course, this is an argument for the pilot wave ontology. But it, you know, another quote from Bell, but the wave turns out, at least in existing formulations of the theory, to be a wave that propagates not in 3-space but in 3n space, which is sort of puzzling. So for me, the you know, fantasy theory that I would like to do some work to try to end up in someday is a pilot wave theory of exclusively local beables. And it's a pilot wave theory because to me that's the ontology that seems to be far and away the most natural one to sort of read off you know, from experiments like the two-slit experiment in an inference to the best explanation sort of way. And it will have to be a theory of exclusively local Beables, because I just don't know how one could possibly imagine reading off non-local Beables in that, you know, inference to the best explanation kind of way, at least not in any simple way. So that's the motivation for this project for me. I will continue the tradition of quoting Einstein here to capture his and my own attitude toward accepting a field on some abstract high-dimensional space as part of the physical reality of the theory. So these are a bunch of quotes just from letters that Einstein was writing to his colleagues right around the time that Schrodinger came out with the Schrodinger equation, which of course is an equation for a field on this abstract high-dimensional space. So for example, Schrodinger's works are wonderful, but even so, one nevertheless hardly comes closer to a real understanding. The field in a many-dimensional coordinate space just does not smell like something real. The method of Schrodinger seems indeed more correctly conceived than that of Heisenberg, and yet it is hard to place a function in coordinate space and view it as an equivalent for a motion. But if one could succeed in doing something similar in four-dimensional space, then it would be more satisfying. Of the new attempts to obtain a deeper formulation of the quantum laws, that by Schrodinger pleases me most. If only the undulatory fields introduced there could be transplanted from the n-dimensional coordinate space to the three or four-dimensional. Schrodinger is, in the very beginning, very captivating, but the waves in n-dimensional coordinate space are indigestible. So that sort of captures my own attitude toward the configuration space wave function taken as a Beable in pilot wave theory. I think it's maybe of some historical interest that this kind of attitude that Einstein is expressing probably accounts for his relatively and surprisingly cool reaction to that same theory, which of course he saw de Broglie develop and then later saw Bohm rediscover. Okay, so sort of given everything I've said so far, you might think that the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory would be the last place you'd want to start if you want to try to find a theory of exclusively local Beables, because it seems somehow so important in that particular theory that you take the wave function as this really existing field. I can do no better than quote, again, Bell's statement of this. Note that in this compound dynamical system, here he's talking about the pilot wave theory, the wave is supposed to be just as real and objective as, say, the field of classical Maxwell theory, although its action on the particles is rather original. No one can understand this theory until he is willing to think of psi as a real objective field rather than just a probability amplitude, even though it propagates not in 3-space but in 3n space. But what I want to say is that nevertheless, despite this appearance, this theory seems to me a very natural starting point for attempting to construct, what one might say, reverse engineer a pilot wave type theory of exclusively local Beables, because one of the things that you get in this theory that you don't get anything like this quite so easily in any other theory is basically one particle wave functions, which you can define as so-called conditional wave functions in the theory. And those are fields on physical space, right? So what you do is just take the big wave function and evaluate it, at the positions of all the other particles. That gives you a field on at least something that's isomorphic to physical space. And you can take that as a really existing field that's somehow associated with the one particle that was the one left out when you evaluated it at all, the actual positions of all the other particles. Of course, the other important formula in this theory is the guidance formula, which tells you how the particles move under the influence of the waves. And it's perhaps obvious but worth mentioning that the usual, that formula for each, the motion, that formula for the individual, velocity of each separate particle can be written just in terms of its own conditional wave function. And so you seem to have here a kind of foothold onto exactly the sort of ontology that I was lobbying for earlier. For a universe of n, by the way, non-relativistic spinless particles, you can take the positions of all the particles and, what is from the perspective of this full configuration space pilot wave theory, the conditional wave function for each particle, and take that as your ontology. That seems like a kind of nice place to start. Okay. just another interesting historical aside. There's this nice paper by the historian Linda Wessels called Schrodinger's Route to Quantum Mechanics or something like that. And in a footnote of that paper, she quotes from an interview that John Heilbronn did with Carl Eckert, and Eckert makes this claim that this notion of sort of chopping up the configuration space wave function, you know, for n particles into n fields on 3-space was, quote, something everybody was trying to do back at the time. And of course, in some sense or other, they failed. And then I think this research program has been largely forgotten about. Anyway, the point, of course, is that this doesn't work, and you can't just say, like, you know, the particle positions and the conditional wave functions are the ontology for my theory, and then, you know, I like that ontology, and the theory is well-defined, and so we're done. It doesn't work. You can't do that. So I've cooked up this kind of simple example just to explain, I think, clearly why it doesn't work. So suppose you have two particles moving in one spatial dimension, just so we have a nice two-dimensional configuration space and we can draw pictures. And then I put in some kind of short-range interaction for them, and then consider, you know, a scattering experiment where the normal way of talking about it would be that initially one of the particles is sitting there at the origin and the other one gets shot in, okay? And so two things can happen, right? The one can sort of tunnel through, or there can be like this billiard ball interaction like this. Now, so what's pictured here is like the dynamics in configuration space. The dark gray blob over there is meant to be the initial packet sort of heading into the right, and then the two light gray blobs are you know, the two wave packets that represent the two possible outcomes of this scattering experiment. The diagonal gray line is meant to be like, you know, the contact potential between the two particles, and of course in the configuration space that just sort of functions like a beam splitter, right? So the idea is, from the point of view of the normal, you know, configuration space pilot wave theory, in addition to the wave function, there's, you know, the actual configuration, which is represented by the little black dots in the picture. And then the funny dotted lines that you see going up and down are meant to just sort of remind you how you calculate the conditional wave function for the different particles, right? So, for example, you know, look at the black dot in the dark gray blob. The horizontal dotted line going through there is, so to speak, where the conditional wave function for particle one lives, and what it looks like is just some kind of ordinary wave packet. And same thing for particle two going the other way. And so if you sort of make that translation, then what emerges is that the conditional wave functions for the two particles act kind of more or less the way that you would expect good one-particle wave functions to act in an experiment like this. They have the structure at the beginning that you would sort of attribute to them unthinkingly if you were just, you know, speaking with undergraduates learning quantum mechanics about how to talk about this. And they do also at the end, notice that, you know, the actual configuration takes one or the other of these two, you know, follows one or the other of these two wave packets that develop. And so the, you know, the point is just that there's no like funny collapsed postulate that one needs to add or something in order to get what's sort of sensible, nice behavior for the final states. Anyway, the point is that the proper dynamics for the particles, right, the one that you get from the configuration space pilot wave theory and want to somehow or other reproduce, you can't reproduce it this way. Okay, so why not? Sure. I don't want to get any different outcomes. So I'm about to tell you why this doesn't work. I mean, so let me just sort of summarize. We have the configuration space pilot wave theory, and, you know, to whatever extent one kind of shares my attitudes, one is maybe motivated to try to retool it somehow in order to have an ontology that is more amenable, right? And the initial motivating thought is, well, the particle positions and the conditional wave functions would sort of satisfy that. Can I have just those as my ontology? And the answer is no, and so I'm in the process of trying to explain why the answer is no. Okay. So why can't you just have that as the ontology? And so here's a kind of similar scattering experiment. So you know, the sort of now two dark gray lumps represent a single initial condition. So the initial condition now has entanglement, and you can arrange for the final state to be different, right? Because these two sort of incoming wave packets in the configuration space can be made to interfere so as to guarantee now one of what was before two, you know, possible outcomes for different initial conditions. And so then the point is that you can have precisely the same initial positions for the particles and precisely the same conditional wave functions for both particles, but get a different outcome. Okay? You see that? I mean, so the point is just, therefore, if what you want to do is reproduce the usual trajectories for the particles, then something has to change, right? You have to either add something to the ontology or change the laws around or something, but just the particles and the conditional wave functions are not going to suffice to define a theory that gives rise to the same, you know, trajectories as the ordinary pilot wave theory does. Is that clear? Anthony's shaking his head no. Well, maybe I'll go on, and it sort of doesn't matter. I mean, this is like why a certain... I don't know quite what you mean. I don't have any equations yet. I haven't said anything really about that. So maybe just hold off, and if you're still confused, then by all means we can straighten it out. But okay, so here's sort of the same point, really, from a slightly more formal perspective. I mean, the conditional wave function is defined, you know, in a certain way in the theory, and one can just ask, okay, how does this thing evolve in time? And it's trivial to calculate that. And you can do it like this, and here's what it looks like. And then the point is that you get some terms out which can simply not be written in terms of, you know, what I've said so far I want the ontology to be, right? So these last two terms on the right-hand side of the sort of Schrodinger-like equation for, you know, the time evolution of the conditional wave function of particle one. Sorry about all the prepositions there. The last two terms on the right-hand side of that equation simply can't be written in terms of conditional wave functions and particle positions for the different particles, right? They involve sort of derivatives in this other orthogonal direction in the configuration space. Okay, well, so you could give up and say, all right, therefore you can't have a pilot wave theory whose ontology is particles and, you know, one particle wave functions. But my attitude about this, you know, the offending terms on the right-hand side is that they just tell us precisely what we could add to the ontology in order to then have a dynamics that sort of closes. So here are some new fields, again, fields on physical space, which is, of course, the crucial point to make this a theory of exclusively local beables. Here are some things that you could just grant beable status to, right? Just say, oh, there are these other fields around, and here's how they relate to the configuration space wave function. And then there's no problem with the Schrodinger-like equation from the previous slide, right, that tells you how the conditional wave function for one particle evolves in time, because now all the right-hand, all the stuff on the right-hand side, right, exists, okay? So, of course, now this new stuff that I'm saying also exists is also going to change in time in some way. And I can figure out how I should, you know, say that it changes in time in order to, again, reproduce what I know is sort of acceptable family of trajectories for the particles by just calculating it from, you know, the usual Schrodinger equation. In other words, just by playing the same game that I played before. And so that's the theory. And so just to summarize how that works, and I'm... You know, for the record, I will officially be the first to call this contrived and ridiculous and even kind of trivial. So be it. Here's the theory. Each particle consists of the following: a literal particle, that, you know, something that follows a definite trajectory, a pilot wave field, which you should think of as the conditional wave function in regular de Broglie-Bohm theory, and then an infinite number of these other fields, which I had to posit in order to sort of reproduce sensible dynamics for the earlier stuff. But all of these things are just fields on ordinary physical space. So this is a theory of exclusively local Biebles, whatever else you think about it. And just to be really explicit, instead of doing what, you know, quote unquote, everyone was trying to do back in the 20s, that is replacing this function on 3n space with n functions on 3 space, we replace the one function on 3n space with a countable infinity of functions on 3 space. So that's moderately embarrassing. And it would be nice to be able to do better. And I suspect that one could do better. In fact, I explore in the version of this that I wrote up and put on the archive recently, at least one really baby step toward doing a little bit better that is probably not even worth going into. But the point is that, you know, you can see this as a kind of first attempt at something whose value lies in setting up a kind of definite problem for improving it. And there are some ideas for how that could be done. So just to say sort of something about the big picture, I think of this in my own head as the forgotten argument for the pilot wave ontology, which is not that it's, you know, the most elegant solution to the measurement problem or something like that, but just that it provides for the kinds of experiments typically involving single particles that made people create quantum mechanics in the first place, and what we all teach to all of our students as the evidentiary basis for the theory. The sort of basic qualitative pilot wave ontology, for me at least, provides an extremely natural, simple, straightforward explanation of all that stuff. That's why I want to believe in that ontology. And then, unfortunately, despite its many other virtues, the existing formulations of the pilot wave theory can't really figure in that kind of explanation, because the only wave that really exists according to that theory is the big wave that lives on this funny abstract high-dimensional space. And so you really shouldn't, I think, say things which people say. Bell says things like this occasionally. That, according to this pilot wave theory, you can understand what's happening in the double slit experiment by thinking about, there's a particle that takes one definite trajectory, but then there's this wave that goes through both slits and interferes with itself and then pushes the particle around. I mean, strictly speaking, there's no such thing happening in that particular region of space, according to the regular configuration space theory. Okay, so to me, what we really want is a theory that starts with that qualitative ontology, but then allows us to actually make sense of the experiments that motivated it in the first place. And so then we know now that in order for such a theory to really be fully empirically viable, it's going to have to incorporate what's sort of proprietarily called entanglement according to ordinary quantum mechanics. And that's going to involve adding some extra Biebles to the theory, or maybe changing the dynamics, or probably both. And somehow or other, that should happen in a way that's sort of more believable than the way that I've sketched. But I think there's maybe some room for optimism that such a thing could exist. Okay. So that's sort of all I have to say. But I thought it would be kind of appropriate to share some of my own questions about all of this. So one is something I guess I already mentioned. Despite my suggestions that the usual quantum state isn't a Biebel, that is, isn't sort of part of the ontology of this theory, it turns out that according to the Rob Speckens criterion of what's ontic, the configuration space wave function is ontic for this theory, because if I give you all of the stuff that I'm positing as Biebles for this theory, then you can figure out exactly what you know, the full configuration space wave function was. It's uniquely defined. So maybe there's sort of something to talk about there. This question actually came from Shelley Goldstein, who is not yet with us this week. What's the point of doing this, since we already know from Bell's theorem that we're going to have non-locality in the dynamics of this theory? I think one can quite reasonably have the attitude that the distinction between local beables and non-local beables gets rather fuzzy, or maybe even pointless in the presence of explicit dynamical non-locality in the laws. A nice sort of example to have in mind to understand that point is just to say, look, if you're going to have non-locality in the laws anyway, then why don't you just take the big configuration space wave function and say that it lives right there, right? And now that object is a local beable, which non-locally influences the trajectories of all the particles in the universe. So, I think that's a kind of sensible objection. On the other hand, that strikes me as sort of cheating or kind of like implausible as an ontology. So I don't regard that as a fatal kind of objection at all. A very different kind of question I have has to do with sort of what we take to be, what we take relativity theory to be. I mean, a big concern for people who are in the game of trying to come up with new theories is consistency with relativity in light of Bell's theorem. It seems like maybe something has to give. There are some ideas out there for how you could have a fully Lorentz invariant theory that is, you know, sort of nevertheless has the required kind of non-locality in it. And I think such theories are very important, but something that just bothers me about that is that you still have, you know, this funny object in the theories which doesn't live in ordinary, you know, 3+1 dimensional space-time at all. And, you know, to me, that seems like a kind of relevant issue when you're talking about consistency with relativity. So I just genuinely wonder if maybe exploring theories of exclusively local beables wouldn't be another kind of helpful direction to probe in trying to reconcile quantum mechanics with relativity. Though I should, you know, also say that I don't think for a second that there's any hope of finding a theory of exclusively local beables with exclusively local dynamics too. I think such a thing is, you know, already ruled out by Bell's theorem. But I think there are some interesting questions there. And then there's this other issue. I mean, I've only sort of talked about these two options from the very beginning for the status of the quantum state, like, is it ontic or epistemic? And of course there's people who want to say, well, it's kind of something else. It's got this gnomic or law-like status. And so I guess I like to think of this project as sort of related to the idea that you should interpret the wave function in Bohm's theory as gnomic, in that both of those, you know, both that claim and my project are, I think, you know, to be honest about it, motivated in some way by a sort of embarrassment about having to posit non-local beables, because that's just a very unusual and uncomfortable sort of thing to have to believe in. And then maybe you have some questions too, or maybe some of you can answer some of those, but that's all I have to say, so thank you. Unsurprisingly.
Leslie Ballantyne here. I just want to say I very much appreciated your discussion at the beginning of ontic versus epistemic and warning against the oversimplifications that result from pigeoning theories and people into those pigeonholes. I'd intended to say something about this at the end of my talk, but ran out of time. It was probably a good thing because you did a better job than I would. So thanks for that.
Yeah, thanks.
Two questions. First of all, when you talk about non-local beables and feel a shudder when you think about them, are you worried about beables which are not localized within a very small region of space? Or is it the worry about things which aren't located in three-dimensional space or four-dimensional space-time at all? That's the first question.
Okay, can I answer that one? Because I'll probably forget it by the time you ask this.
Go ahead.
Having said that, I don't really know how to answer it, but I mean...
Well, I have another one.
I don't know. I mean, I guess... To me, there's a kind of fuzziness in the boundary between local beables and non-local beables, and one can consider, you know, just the sort of thing you apparently must have in mind, like things that sort of live in ordinary space-time, but, you know, aren't fields with well-defined values at a point, or, you know, something that's sort of obviously a local beable in that sense. And I don't know, I mean, you know, the sort of fuzziness is at the boundary between two things that clearly lie along some kind of spectrum, and you know, the extent to which I'm bothered by having to believe in the reality of these things pretty much, you know, goes monotonically with position along that spectrum. So, you know,
okay.
All other things being equal, I'd rather have, you know, particles and fields, right? Like have a very classical E&M type ontology. That would be fantastic. And, you know, if you told me, well, I definitely can't have that, but either I can have, you know, some funny like loops in space that, you know, so there's some kind of like non-separability in the ontology or something, but it's still sort of non-separability in ordinary physical space. I, you know, if you told me I had to choose between that and, you know, a field on a bajillion dimensional space, I'd probably go with the former. Right?
Okay. The second one, I'm a bit worried about your revised version of ontic commitment. It sounds like Quine, and, you know, if you have to quantify over these things in your regimented formulation of your theory, then you're committed to their existence. And then I worry about whether you're going to be saying, well, you should be ontic about Hilbert space or ontic about numbers or something, because in order to formulate your theory, you have to use some sort of mathematics. And then that's getting you into the indispensability argument for reality of abstract objects like numbers, and that seems to have sort of missed the point of the distinctions that were being made originally between epistemic and ontic.
I'm not sure I really understand everything that you're saying there. There's definitely a sense in which the well, when you say the, you know, the original distinction between epistemic and ontic, do you mean the, you know, the one that's proposed and talked about by people in this room, or
yes.
Okay. Well, then, for sure, I mean, I think what I mean by ontic is not the same thing as what Rob Speckhens means by ontic when he talks about that and uses that terminology. So, I mean, one shouldn't really read my initial comments, I think, so much as a criticism of that, but just as, you know, there's another issue, you know, for which maybe some of the same terminology applies, and then we should kind of be clear about which issue we're talking about when. I would argue that, you know, my issue is somehow more fundamental, but maybe, you know, it's enough for right now just to say that I certainly acknowledge that there are these sort of different issues, and that, you know, ontic for me doesn't mean the same as for some other people in, you know, in that way.
Well, somebody else might.
Okay.
Thanks. Mike Taylor. Are we not just confusing the formal machinery of the model with the reality that the model represents? I mean, using a multidimensional mathematical space to model phenomena does not, in my opinion, necessarily require an ontological commitment to the physical existence of a multidimensional space. Yeah? I mean, what I've always thought is that the many-particle wave function defined on a 3n-dimensional space is a mathematical representation of an objectively real field in physical 3D space, right? I mean, is that coherent? Yeah, because a simply connected 3D space by itself can't describe all the holistic quantum connectedness and non-locality features of multi-particle systems. We're just doing that formally by employment of a multidimensional conflict space, okay? All we're really saying is we don't know the means by which these quantum non-local connections are actualized. Is that not right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's easy to say what you said, right? It's easy to say, oh, well, you know, you shouldn't be bothered by having this field on a high-dimensional space because really it's just a representation of something mundane and easy to believe in. I mean, that's what you said, right? You want the microphone back, so I guess that's not.
No, sure, that's right. But you're just confusing the mathematics with the reality. I mean, we use a multidimensional configuration space in classical mechanics, right?
Yes.
But it's just a convenient summary of the positions of all the particles. And, you know, there are these two separate things, the mathematics and the real, and one is just representing the other. You can use the 3N-dimensional space to represent the real physical 3D space.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly accept...
You're just encoding the non-local interactions.
Well, I mean, I guess then, in some sense, that's just what I'm trying to do, but to make it explicit rather than hand-wavy.
Yeah.
I mean, one could take precisely that attitude on this project, is to say, look, you know, the ordinary configuration space wave function is just some kind of funny mathematical summary of a bunch of stuff that exists in a mundane way in physical space.
Yeah, exactly. So
here's what that is.
If we did know the means by which the non-local connections were actualized, we might write the whole thing in a different way.
Yes.
I think we're agreeing, really.
Okay.
Hi, Howard Wiseman. I think since Rob's too polite to criticize someone he invited to come and talk, I'll do the job for him.
Good.
I think in the paper that Rob and Nick Harrigan wrote about where they defined the term psiontic and psi epistemic, that they were specifically in the context of hidden variable theories and how psi might be interpreted in that. So, I mean, so I don't think it's really fair to criticize that, to say that, you know, oh, the problem with that definition is that psi epistemic includes all this vast array of completely different attitudes towards the theory, because in fact, I mean, I think their psi epistemic as used in their paper was specifically in the context, you know, where there was were ontic states as well, and so the sort of the radical Bayesian interpretation, you know, that other people are talking about here is not, you know, a psi epistemic interpretation.
I mean, yeah, I agree.
My terminology, I'd say that's actually that's an instrumental approach to psi, not an epistemic approach to psi at all.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, part of this is just terminological, but I certainly agree that the, you know, radical solipsist Bayesian attitude, that's just a joke. I know, because you made me watch this video where you talked about how you hated it when people say that. I'm fully aware that that's not what, you know, Rob meant by psi epistemic, and I think Rob and I share, you know, sort of the attitude that that's kind of not the right approach somehow. So, you know, to whatever extent it came off as if it was a criticism of that, then I didn't intend that at all.
I think part of the problem is that the community felt we had to move on beyond the term hidden variable, and so the term ontic was adopted. And the trouble is that the word ontic or ontological has sort of two meanings. It has the meaning of suggesting that something is real. But then beyond that, there's a kind of sense of there being a picture of reality associated with that thing.
Sure.
Whereas the term hidden variable doesn't necessarily commit yourself to any particular picture of reality. And then the terminology that psiontic and psiepistemic was really carrying no commitment to any sort of pictorial notion of the variables concerned.
Right.
Whereas I think some of your criticisms did imply a commitment to some kind of picture associated with the variables.
Well, not my criticisms of that terminology, but, you know, maybe my criticisms of some other theories that I don't like as much.
For example, you said your model doesn't contain psi as such,
right?
But mathematically, it does contain psi. So the hidden variable does contain psi. So in that sort of mathematical sense of the notion, it contains psi. But in the picture, but in,
right.
in the pictorial sense, it doesn't contain a non-local field.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But I mean, to me, it's, you know, this is what I had in mind with, like, the example of the GRWF versus GRWM versus the bare GRW theory, that kind of thing. I mean, there's got at some level to be some kind of distinctions between like stuff that is somehow or other in the ontology, right, which is a the sort of broader category, versus stuff that is the ontology, like what really fundamentally exists according to the theory. And I mean, you know, that's the answer to, you know, the question or one of the examples that Mike raised too. You know, even in classical physics, we deal with configuration space, but we're not bothered by it, and we understand why. And you know, there is a sense in which, you know, the configurations, you know, the actual realized configuration space point is sort of in the ontology of classical physics. But you know, somehow we don't think that commits us to the existence of, you know, a sort of parallel universe of very high dimension. In the same way that I think, at least until somebody figures out how to, you know, tell me exactly what how the representation works, right? Then I don't know. So I think you get the point from that.
Delightful talk.
Thanks.
I'm curious, this bunch of little waves, the local variables, does it contain arbitrarily high order derivatives?
Yeah, I mean, it has to,
yeah,
in order to exactly reproduce.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If
I combine that with Taylor's theorem, doesn't that get me back to not?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in a way, that's precisely what's going on here. It's like a kind of reproduction of the full quantum state by Taylor expansion.
Uh-huh.
That's I think, a helpful sort of way of saying what's really going on, and a helpful way of saying why it's kind of embarrassingly trivial, too, right?
Very entertaining.
Well, thanks. I aim to please.
I'm going to cheat again. I have a follow-up on that.
Sure.
Could I do the same thing and Taylor expand everything around the point in configuration space 0000? Now I have a complete description of my multi-dimensional field that lives at a single point.
I don't get the last part about it living at a single point, but it is kind of unnecessary to carry out this sort of Taylor expansion around the actual configuration space point, and doing so no doubt complicates the dynamics for these individual local viable fields that you want to put in the ontology. And so you might ask, like, why bother? Why don't you just sort of take the origin of configuration space and Taylor expand around that? And then, you know, the math is a little bit simpler. And I don't know, there's probably no good answer to that except, again, to appeal to my sort of subjective sense that somehow the conditional wave function, as it's normally defined in de Broglie-Bohm theory, somehow seems like it's a kind of reasonable thing to believe in. I'm reminded, by the way, of Professor Merman's claim during his talk that many physicists reify the wave function. And I wanted to remember to say that you could sort of understand my project as thinking, well, maybe there's a good reason why all these, you know, relatively sensible, intelligent people want to believe in, you know, the real existence of a sort of field that, I can't remember what your example was, two-slit experiment or something, right? So my project, in a way, is to take what you describe as a kind of common mistake that people mistake and convert it into, you know, something that's valid.
If I've understood the distinction that you drew at the beginning correctly, I sort of want to put my own words to it, but you sort of have a primitive ontology, and then you have things that supervene on that in the sense that you know, information about the primitive ontology will determine the values of those.
That's
things.
Right.
So, you know, the phase-space point supervenes on the positions of all the particles.
That's right. And the stuff that supervenes on the primitive ontology kind of doesn't exist in the same way.
Yeah, it's somehow less real or just has a different sort of status.
Yeah, and I would say it involves a certain kind of human perspective on what's real, and that's why it's in that sense that it doesn't exist in the same way. But I'm with you.
Okay, and so you sent me a paper by Tim Maudlin to read a few weeks ago, and I looked at it, and he talks about different notions of supervenience. Yeah. And there were some examples in that paper that I thought, for me at least, made it sort of uncomfortable to say that, you know, if I can figure something out from the information in another, then it can't be as real. And so, you know, one of the examples was if I have a deterministic theory, then the state at one time completely determines the state at another time. Yeah. So wouldn't this sort of philosophy lead you to say, well, ultimately there's only, you know, the only thing that's primitively real is the state at one time, and the states at all the other times are somehow less real because they can be determined from the state?
Well, it wouldn't lead me to say that, but you know, perhaps you're right that the particular attitude that you're questioning about might lead one to say that. I mean, I would never be motivated to say that because I think that we know something about ontology just from ordinary experience. And so, you know, to say only the initial conditions of the universe are really real is just sort of not plausible to me.
Well, you did have that definition early on that said if I can drop X from my theory, you know,
yeah,
consequences, then I should do so. So how do you escape from the idea of dropping the state at every time the initial time?
That's not what I said. It's not that if you can drop X from the theory, then you should do so. In other words, then you should treat it not as really existing. But rather, if you can't drop X, then you're not really entitled to say that it's not physically real. Right? Then you have to grant ontic status to it. But just because you can drop it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, right? I mean, you can drop electric and magnetic fields from the formulation of classical E&M by writing it in terms of, you know, scalar and vector potentials, but I mean, that doesn't prove that electric, you know, that you should believe in the potentials as the real ontology and the fields as, you know, something secondary. There's some other criteria that has to come in to sort of decide between those two and many, many other, you know, related theories.
Okay. So on that, just going back to Richard's point, which I don't think you answered fully. So Richard was saying that if you have this indispensability criteria, okay, so if you've got a piece of an element in your theory that is indispensable and you can't formulate the theory without it, then it's real, then you are led to make all sorts of claims about numbers existing, because presumably you can't formulate the theory without mathematics. So you're led to make all sorts of strange or radical ontic claims on the basis of this definition.
Like the plus sign in Maxwell's equations is part of the ontology.
Or just numbers in general. If you need mathematics to formulate the theory, then you're led to the existence as real things, ontically, the existence of mathematics. And that's not really you don't really want to be committed to that just because you believe in some other elements of your physical theory.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to say about that, except that I don't really want to go there, so...
Well, precisely, but your definition of ontic leads you there.
I appreciate the point, and I guess I'm saying I just don't have any really good answer to it right now, but, I mean, somehow it doesn't strike me as, all that crucial an issue somehow, and, you know, there's going to turn out to be some sort of reasonable way of saying which kinds of things I'm talking about in that criterion of, you know, what you should take as being ontic for a given theory, where, you know, the language in which it's expressed is sort of not part of that somehow. But
also, there's a very easy way of dealing with Rob's point about the times and the fact that why can't you just make do with one time since it's determining all the other times, which is that the proper definition of supervenience is that there's no change in the supervenient properties without some change in the
subvenient properties.
Right.
So it's obvious that when you're dealing with other times and these kinds of things, changing the other properties can happen without changing the previous properties.
In a deterministic theory? I don't understand. In a deterministic theory, that should be true.
It doesn't really seem to have the same kind of connection.
Well, I don't know. Maybe I don't quite understand the point then. Okay.
Well, I think this is an excellent time to thank the speaker again and go refill on coffee.